Hello, I'm Catherine Jansen, editor of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. I'm delighted to welcome you to another episode of Speculum Spotlight, a collaboration with the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. Each episode is intended to bring you behind the scenes of an article published in our current issue. Today, we listen in on a conversation about burial archaeology and the first plague pandemic, published in the April 2025 issue of the journal. This multi-authored interdisciplinary article, conceived during the COVID-19 lockdown, makes the case for attending to and incorporating the archaeological evidence from burial sites and cemeteries from the first plague pandemic, a period reaching from the 6th to 8th centuries. That is, the authors argue that we must incorporate not only the new and exciting paleogenetic evidence of the plague pandemic, gleaned from skeletal remains, largely from teeth, but also the bioarchaeological evidence and indeed the funerary contexts of burials. In so doing, we will be able to set local instances of the pandemic in their proper historical contexts to better understand the impact of plague on individuals and communities. The wide-ranging conversation in this podcast discusses topics that include the ethical questions associated with the application of cutting-edge scientific techniques to human remains, to what research on ancient plague can teach us about modern plague responses, and, as one of the authors note, the past is a powerful tool for understanding the present. The host and producer of the episode is Reid O'Mara, a PhD candidate in the Department of Art History and Art at Case Western University, and the current graduate intern in the Department of Manuscripts at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. In conversation with Reid today are three of the seven co-authors of this article. Janet Kay is an early medieval archaeologist and historian at Princeton University. She uses biomolecular and funerary archaeology to focus on how people living in 5th century Britain adapted to the seeming material collapse of their society. Her work has appeared in PNAS, Medieval Archaeology, Internet Archaeology, and Medicine Historisches Journal. Rachel Singer, one of the co-authors, is a PhD candidate in history at Georgetown University. Her research focuses on infectious disease and climate change in post-Roman Britain and gender in Merovingian Gaul. Her work has appeared in the Journal of Medieval Worlds, Early Medieval Europe, and the English Historical Review. And finally, Jordan Wilson is a biological anthropologist and bioarchaeologist. Her research explores human skeletal health and development, particularly in the context of disease, along with the biosocial complexities of death and burial. She is currently a postdoctoral fellow at Georgetown University within the Earth Commons Institute, where she is researching malaria in the ancient Mediterranean using a One Health perspective. Let's now turn to their conversation, which takes as its starting point their article, Burial Archaeology and the First Plague Pandemic, hot off the press in the April 2025 issue of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. See you on the other side.
Welcome to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. My name is Reid O'Mara, and today I will be talking with Janet E. Kay, Jordan Wilson, and Rachel Singer, the co-authors of Burial Archaeology and the First Plague Pandemic, an article that is appearing in the April issue of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. I just want to give a little bit of a content warning as we will be talking about plague and obviously, as you might expect, we will also be talking about death, The COVID-19 pandemic also comes up. So if these are things you'd rather not listen to, maybe just skip to next month's episode. To get us started, let's just go straight into introductions. Janet, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Janet Kay. I'm an early medieval archaeologist and historian at Princeton University.
Welcome to the podcast. Jordan?
Hi, I'm Jordan Wilson. I'm a bioarchaeologist, and I am a postdoc at the Earth Commons Institute at Georgetown University.
Perfect. Thank you. And Rachel?
I'm Rachel Singer. I'm a PhD candidate, also at Georgetown, but based in the history department.
Okay, perfect. Thank you all so much for joining us on the podcast today to talk about this article. And I think it's already evident in your introductions that you come from a lot of different fields and backgrounds. And so this collaboration for this article is, I think, pretty exciting. So let's get into it. So we're talking, obviously, about burial archaeology and the first plague pandemic. Maybe you can first outline for our listeners what we even mean when we say the first plague pandemic.
Start with the easy questions, huh, Reed? No, thanks for inviting us. And it's really exciting to be here. And as you pointed out, this is a super interdisciplinary article. It argues that in the study of the first plague pandemic, the first kind of large scale outbreak of plague, Y. pestis, Yersinia pestis, starting in the mid 6th century and continuing through the 8th. And the article specifically argues that we need to have more burial archaeology in our interdisciplinary discussions of the pandemic itself, as well as what's called the Justinianic Plague, the first few years when it was an outbreak centered in the Eastern Mediterranean. Because archaeology has been kind of quietly there in the background in the scholarly debates over the last 20 or so years, especially, usually as a repository of plague genomes or genome sampling to figure out what exactly this was. And that sampling is important because it wasn't until 2005 that it was confirmed that the first pandemic was in fact plague caused by Y. pestis. But archaeology has so much more to offer, and we argue as a collective interdisciplinary team of historians and scientists and archaeologists that we really need to focus on the archaeology as its own set of data and framework for questions that can be answered.
Just to back up a little bit more for any audience member who is lucky enough not to spend every instant of their life steeped in this ridiculousness, we call it the first plague pandemic because there are three. The one that we focus on, as Janet said, is from the mid-6th century to the 8th. The second one is the one that everyone will have heard of. That is the one that starts with the Black Death in the 14th century and keeps going, depending on who you ask, until the 18th, probably most of the time. And then there is a third plague pandemic, which starts in the 19th century and is still ongoing. That is the one that modernists might have heard of that turns up in places like San Francisco and the Indian subcontinent and Hong Kong. The reason that these are all three plague pandemics is that, as Janet mentioned, they're all caused by the same pathogen, the bacterium Yersinia pestis. But one of the big contributions of our article is to argue that the fact that they're all caused by the same pathogen tells us less about each individual pandemic as previous scholars have thought, because plague is kind of weird. Unlike pathogens like flu that we might be familiar with nowadays, it doesn't evolve very quickly. So when we first got its genetic information, everyone was struck by how similar really, really old plague is to really, really new plague. But yet, it's behaved really differently in different times and places. Like the second and third plague pandemics, which we have way more documentation of than the one that we work on, are really, really different. Like there's just a much lower mortality rate in the third pandemic, and everyone's always been sort of baffled by why that might have been. And it looks increasingly like it's the fact that Yersinia pestis is so ecologically ingrained and sensitive. Like it is mostly a disease of rodents. That is its normal state. So nowadays it exists out in the wild in rodent reservoirs in places like Central Asia and the American Southwest. And what it wants to do is just hang out in those rodents and not bother people. Like something has to go wrong to cause it to spill over into people. And then once it does, it's still generally mediated and spread by rodents and their ectoparasites. So it's really sensitive to things like landscape and house much salt there is in the soil and what the climate conditions are like and the density of the populations of rodents and people. So it's just so weird and so complicated that seems to be why it's so different across time and space.
You raised so many really great points here, both of you. I mean, also, I will just say I'm in Southern California right now, and I have also recently learned about this plague being in the squirrel population, and it's terrifying to me. But one of the really interesting things that you've teased out here is that the first plague pandemic and, let's say, you know, the second plague pandemic are often thought of, oh, we can study them the same way because it's like the same disease, essentially. But as you've pointed out, there are different responses to it. They function differently within the communities that they affect. And so I think this leads us to a good question about how has our study of the second plague pandemic, so the Black Death, as you've said, the one that's way more famous, I think, especially perhaps for these listeners, how has the study of the second plague pandemic affected the study of the first?
I think a disclaimer we have to put at the beginning of this is because so much of this is based on fast-changing science, a lot of what we say might not still be in date in the next 5 to 10 years. So anybody listening to this at any point in the future should not listen to me. They should go find out what's come out since then. But basically, even before we had the scientific confirmation that these diseases were caused by the same pathogen, people basically assumed that they were because the descriptions of them in the textual evidence is pretty similar. There's only really one place where we have a very significant amount of textual evidence for the first pandemic, so we'll get into later how that might be a little bit misleading. But it led people to just assume that things we knew about the 14th century could be transplanted back onto the 6th with very little change. The discovery that the pathogens were in fact the same, and also that the pathogen had not changed very much between the 6th and the 14th centuries, really emboldened people to keep doing that. But there are so many differences between that occurred in that time span that would be relevant from a plague ecology perspective. With the second pandemic, we tend to take the example of England and spread it everywhere because that's where all of the evidence is. The same thing happens for the first pandemic with Byzantium.
And I think part of it too, in addition to everything Rachel just said, is, you know, most of what we know about how plague works actually comes from the third plague pandemic, which, as she mentioned, takes place in specific areas of the world, which are not the same parts of the world we're thinking about with the Black Death, usually Italy, England, etc. And it's also really changed by how we perceive just kind of pandemics in general today. One of the issues we tease apart in the article is the common misperception or the common misassumption that mass graves indicate plague or plague death or pandemic death at all. We started writing this article during the COVID lockdowns when we were all seeing these images, especially in the US of Hart Island in New York, where all of the unclaimed COVID bodies or the overflow COVID bodies were being buried in these massive graves. And it was a really evocative image, especially in the US that doesn't see mass graves for other reasons, really, thankfully, in this day and age. So we kind of have this assumption as a field of what death should look like for pandemics. And yet, if you look at the archaeology really closely, even in places where we have relatively high positive sampling rates, so places like the cemeteries of Aschheim and Altenerding in Bavaria for the first plague pandemic, people are still burying the dead, even if they had plague when they died. They're still burying them like they would other people. They're still getting this respect, the same funerary objects. So what we found just looking at the published data of where positive samples had been retrieved from the archaeology is actually you're more likely to find people who died of plague in normal single inhumations, which are standard across Western Europe at this time, rather than in mass graves or multiple burials where there are more than one person, whether or not they're laid down respectfully or kind of en masse, hence the mass graves. But the point of the article is to sit back and actually look at what we have in its own context.
I think, yeah, just to add from a bioarchaeological perspective, that what we consider to be typical or atypical burials can really, really vary across time and culture, and even for the individual person or people who are receiving that burial treatment. So like Janet was saying, you have to consider everything in this much broader context to understand it.
You guys have all now brought up a lot of things that I really hope that we actually can discuss within the rest of our time here today. And one of the things that is brought up is the like, what evidence do you use to help you understand the context of a plague? And in fact, in the article, you repeatedly highlight the necessity to avoid an over-reliance on genomic evidence extrapolated too far forward. And instead, it would be beneficial to combine it with smaller scale, local level, archaeological and textual evidence to create more complex narratives for these plague events. So I'm wondering if you could just discuss maybe some of the barriers to implementing this kind of research.
I can jump in about some of the limitations of just relying on paleogenomic evidence. And first and foremost, that you are taking that evidence from human remains. And so you need to always be very conscious of that fact, that the kind of analysis where you can get at that information is destructive analysis. So you're taking a piece of a once living person and destroying it forever. So each one of those elements can give you a lot of information about that person's life. You both want to acknowledge that one-time destructive process as both from a research perspective, that's something that you can't undo. You know, you take someone's teeth and you study them or another element. But also you want to respect the integrity of that human being and their remains. It's important when you are thinking about any kind of analysis, especially destructive analysis, that this is a once living person that you are interacting with. And that is evident from that mortuary treatment that they have, that that was something that, you know, they did not do themselves, but that someone in their community or their family did to them. And so you want to be respectful of not only their humanity, but also the way that possibly their descendant community thinks about them, and not overly rely on processes that kind of, I think, divorce the method of analysis from the human person who experienced that illness, that death, and the community that responded to that death.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I mean, the ethics of this are really important. It's one of the reasons that there are so few kind of large-scale sampling projects. One of the ways that scholarship has discussed the paleogenomes, which is a reasonable first step given how virulent we know plague can be in the right ecological conditions, as Rachel pointed out, is that the earlier publications, remember this is 20 years ago now, so when we say earlier, really, it's not that far away. If you find one plague genome in a cemetery population, that's kind of been read as plague was destructive absolutely everywhere in this town, and the entire population must have had it. So finding a positive plague genome somewhere doesn't mean the entire area was wiped out, and the fact that cemeteries where we have plague genomes continue to be used as cemeteries by any number of living communities in the area means that the entire population is still going there, is still burying their dead in the ways that they have for decades, if not centuries. So putting the archaeology back as the center focus of a study rather than kind of something that's hidden in the supplementary information of a science article, which, you know, they have very short word counts. They have 6,000 or 7,000 words. And so lots of stuff gets put in the supplementary information. And the highlight of the article might be, we found plague genomes. And then all of the smaller details get filtered down. So we'd like to argue that the field move towards putting archaeology, putting these people, as Jordan has explained, front and center. It's not just, let's go find the genome. It's, let's understand how this disease in its specific local environments, which may or may not have regional similarities. Let's put the people back at the center of this conversation by looking at their burials, by looking at their bones, by respectfully considering where and when sampling might be appropriate, rather than rely on, say, a text from Constantinople to describe what's happening in Western France or Southern England.
Branching off of that, when we talk about the environment in which these things occurred, we're not talking just about the natural environment, but the social environment as well. All diseases are interacting with people in a really complex biosocial environment. So I think maybe one of the most important points we have taken away from scholarship, especially bioarchaeological research about the second plague pandemic, which we can apply to the first, is that not everyone is susceptible to plague in the same way. And that can come down to biological reasons, but also social reasons. So when you are looking at people in a cemetery and who might have been infected versus who was not infected, then you do want to rely on some of that other evidence to give you insight into what was their social status, what was their occupation, what were they doing on a day-to-day basis that might have brought them in contact with this pathogen versus somebody else buried in that cemetery or a nearby cemetery who maybe had the same kind of like biological vulnerability, but they were not moving through their world in a way that brought them in contact with this pathogen. In the same way that you might have people who are engaging in a social way in a very similar manner. They might have the same status, they might have the same job, and they both come in contact with a certain disease, and then they have differential outcomes based on their own individual biological frailty. These broader contexts are just absolutely critical for understanding transmission and risk and frailty.
We tried to highlight a really good example of combining paleogenomic and archaeological evidence in the latter part of our article, where we tried to highlight the results of an article that came out in 2022 and was lead authored by Miriam Guliel and Marcel Keller, where they found a co-infection, so a simultaneous infection of plague and another pathogen called Haemophilus influenzae serotype B in a young child, where it seemed from deformities on his skeleton, as though the really long name I just said, I'm going to abbreviate now to Hib, where he had had Hib for some time and had remodeled his bones by giving him septic arthritis. And the fact that he was so susceptible to this pathogen in the first place probably means that he was immunocompromised. And he would have already had this pre-existing condition when he came into contact with plague. So it's amazing that we can see so much of this non-elite individual child's experience of disease in the distant past. But what is even more amazing to me is that his community seems to have loved him anyway. They buried him entirely consistently with the way they would anybody else. He still seems, as best as we can tell, to have had value to them equal to anybody else in their community. And given how poorly disabled people have been treated throughout our most recent pandemic, I think that that is perhaps a really valuable lesson we might be able to take from the distant past.
I'm really glad you highlight this example, because I think that we can address here that there is a modern misperception that people in the medieval and ancient past were somehow less affected emotionally by the prevalence of death and disease. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about how does the archaeological evidence actually push back against this idea? And maybe here's also where we can talk about the difference between, as you make clear in your article, the difference between a mass grave and a multiple burial, and then also, of course, there's single burial as well, and what these different archaeological contexts say about people's perception of each other and death and disease.
So Jordan and Janet will handle most of this, but before they do, I just want to jump in and point out that it was way harder to bury someone in the distant past than it is now. People had to physically dig the grave. And if you're in the midst of an epidemic, many of the people doing the physical digging might even be sick themselves. This is a massive labor of love. So I would argue that the very fact that they're burying people at all proves that they care about them, especially because in many contexts in this period, they're not just burying people, they're burying people alongside extremely valuable material objects. So they're not just putting a lot of labor into this act of love, they are also sacrificing functional things that they might need. I just don't think that that can be said not to demonstrate care for the deceased.
I think, and Jordan can definitely speak more to this than I can, because she's published a lot more in kind of the archaeology of emotion, and Jordan, I'm oversimplifying your work. But there is a common misconception, which is not helped by Hollywood, that people in the past didn't feel things as much as we do, because people died all the time, so they must have been quite used to it. I think that's a gross misrepresentation. Human beings in general, just because we experience more death, I hate to think we get used to it, but some of us are probably forced to, doesn't mean the grief gets any easier to handle, especially as individuals, but also as communities. That's what burials are, in a sense. They are a way to provide some kind of closure to the death of a person in the community, as well as the functional aspect of burying a corpse, which, as Rachel pointed out, is a lot of work, especially in the winter.
Some of our best insight into what people were thinking and feeling in the past come from studying burials, and the expressions of grief are often very clear. And grief is an emotion. Grief and mourning, those are emotions that are not exclusive to human beings, by the way. So it doesn't make much sense to assume that people in the past didn't feel with the same intensity that we feel in the present, especially around death and loss. Those are really, really big emotions. And if we see them in other non-human species, then we can assume that they are very, very old indeed. So I think people in the past had a different relationship with death, just in that it was more present. For example, it might have been common 200 years ago for almost everybody to have at least one sibling that had died in childhood that you knew or you could think of, or at least that you knew was part of your family. And that's far less common today. But we shouldn't assume that that presence of death or the proximity to death somehow made people desensitized to it, or rather not quite as desensitized to the idea of death, but their emotional responses to it.
But I do want to speak to the archaeology of how you bury people in Western Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean in this period. The overwhelming standard by the 6th century is single inhumation, by which I mean you carefully dig a grave and put one person in there and bury them according to the customs of your time and place. But we see two variations of this, aside from cremations, which we didn't discuss in the article because it's a different type of burial entirely. But you see graves where there are more than one person, but otherwise buried in the same manner that one person might be. Same thing as a single burial, but with more people. You see this at cemeteries where plague has been found for the 6th century, at places like Aschheim and Altenerding and Edict's Hill, where Rachel's Hib patient was buried in Cambridgeshire. You also see mass graves, and by that term, we mean here a feature, whether or not it's intentionally dug, because if you have a large number of people die at one time, you might not be able to dig a massive grave. The famous one from the Black Death in London called East Smithfield is actually an exception to that rule. London saw the plague coming because they saw what happened in Italy on the continent. And so in advance, they prepared large pits to bury lots of bodies. But the difference between a mass grave and a multiple burial, and the reason it matters for this article and our understanding of plague archaeology, is mass graves are primarily functional features. They are ways to dispose of multiple corpses in a moment where there is not time to dig individual graves for the thousands of people that may be dying in your community. But it also means something very different than a multiple burial, where you're taking the time and the care. The Hib patient was buried with an older adult male whom he was not related to. So there was some kind of meaning behind that multiple burial of that young child with the co-infection who died with plague in his system. Versus if we were to look at the mass graves for Roman Gloucester for the 2nd century, where it looks like bodies were literally dumped into a pit in the ground using a wheelbarrow because of the way the bodies are just higgledy-piggledy in the grave. versus the really careful burial of two people. They mean different things, and the previous literature has not taken that meaning and that archaeological context into as careful consideration as we do in this article and argue should be taken going forward.
Speaking of the child with the co-infection, that is extraordinarily common. And when we are thinking about diseases in the past, and especially these epidemic events, we can be very focused on the one pathogen or trying to identify one single pathogen. And I think it's important to remember, not only are these things existing in a biological space and a social space, but also there are lots of pathogens in that space at the same time. And it's very common for people both in the modern day and in the past to carry co-infections. And those can compound and create obviously worse outcomes for those people. But that can also kind of obscure our trying to isolate and study these things, especially based just on text or even just on looking at human remains, where you can have different diseases embodied in the skeletal tissue.
Although it is fairly unusual and recent that we can see that with that level of specificity. Before, we had genomic testing. We could see if someone had had a chronic condition by looking at their bones in some cases, but we couldn't tell from people's bones whether they had had really sudden acute illnesses that killed them very quickly. Like, you can't look at someone's bones and say, that guy had plague. You have to test genetically for it to be sure. So yes, Jordan is absolutely right that this would have been everywhere in the past, but we're only just now beginning to be able to like scientifically confirm that that was the case and to know exactly which pathogens were at play.
We should emphasize before we all get too excited about what the science can do, right, is recovering those genomes is definitely dependent upon preservation and access. So we can find really cool stuff, but the success rate is still very small compared to what we would get from, say, modern genomics, where you get the whole genome just by getting a drop of blood.
And it's also worth pointing out the caveat that all of these people had to have active infections when they died for us to be able to recover the pathogens from their bones. If you survive plague, your immune system washes it out of your body. So like if we tested your teeth in 1,000 years, you would not test positive for it, even though you'd had it.
These are really important things to highlight. And certainly, yeah, I think that, you know, how this filters down outside of academia can always be a little interesting and a little muddied. So I'm really glad you guys are teasing out these like very specific like caveats and what can and can't be done.
Yeah, but even within academia, to be honest, like you asked before about some of the why not everybody does this. One of the reasons why this work is still fairly uncommon is that it's impossible not to make mistakes if you're working in multiple fields at once. It's very, very difficult. You have to keep track of tons of different kinds of literature. And even if you go the route that we did, where you minimize that impact on any one individual by bringing a big team of specialists in different fields together, there are institutional barriers to that. I mean, historians at least still don't get very much institutional credit for co-authoring something, even though having co-authored something does not necessarily mean that we did less work than we would have if we had single-authored it. So there are a lot of just procedural things in the way.
As we close out this episode and this interview, we might segue to thinking about modern resonances, because within the article, and I think even within this conversation, the presence of COVID-19, it can be felt. It's definitely on people's minds whenever they hear pandemic now. Everyone's always like, yes, the pandemic. So I am curious about what, if anything, do you find that your research on ancient plagues can tell us about our current response to outbreaks of disease?
I think that there are two things that struck me when we were kicking around the idea for this article during lockdown. One was more immediate at the beginning, where, at least from Princeton, we were all watching what was happening in New York City very early on. And because they had a really integrated infrastructure, they were able to respond in ways that other places in the country did not or could not later. Which goes back to Jordan and Rachel's earlier comments that, you know, plague is affected by biological functions and ecological functions, sure, but it's also affected by society. And that's something I don't think we should forget. The other thing that came to mind was that I think our overall mortality rate, at least in the US, in the past week was 1.1%. So it has certainly slowed from when it hit in 2020, but it is still ongoing. And think about how drastically our entire country reacted, responded, changed, or, you know, in some places hasn't changed. But plague, whether or not you go with the kind of catastrophic versions where half of a community died in the Black Death, for example, or if you even take kind of a more conservative approach that maybe 20% of a community in the medieval past would have died from plague, that's a huge difference in numbers. So I think to some extent, we really cannot conceive of how different any plague epidemic in the past, first, second, or third, would have been from what we just lived through. And that's rather humbling and eye-opening as well.
And I'll just reiterate the thing I said before, that like the past does actually teach us that the systemic abandonment of disabled people is not an inevitable feature of all epidemic mortality. So maybe we should try harder next time not to do that. I'm also very struck by the way that social factors have affected different people's periodization of the present pandemic. Like people who don't have pre-existing health conditions are very comfortable saying it's over, and people who do, or people who are around people who do and care about them. But yeah, it's difficult for us to periodize past plague pandemics as well. And it might behoove us as historians to consider the way in which our own biases and the biases of our sources might affect when we can say that they're over.
I absolutely agree.
Certainly, we experienced firsthand during COVID the way that it affected different communities, different people differently based on not just their underlying health conditions, but whether they had access to healthcare, whether they worked in a job that allowed them to work from home, or they had no choice but to be in settings where there was a person-to-person interaction and that risk of transmission, whether you could afford to have your groceries delivered to you versus having to go to the store. And those things can determine whether or not you become infected as much as your own like biological susceptibility. So that's something that I think we see from the epidemics in the past. And there has been a lot of really great scholarship that has come out, particularly in the world of bioarchaeology, linking past epidemic events to COVID and trying to see what we can learn from that, especially to prepare for future pandemics.
I think out of all of the things that all of you have said here, I think what really is important is nuance, right? It's nuance in this article and thinking about the past, but also what it can tell us about current pandemic responses and also just how we even define what a pandemic is in terms of like who it's affecting and how long it lasts. So I think nuance is the key thing here.
COVID is something that we all to a degree had some experience with. And so it's kind of ever present and on our minds. And that can be your immediate reference for what a pandemic is like or some kind of epidemic event on a smaller scale. But that those kinds of crises are ever present in different parts of the world. And I think we have a tendency to not give them the kind of attention that they deserve, possibly because they affect certain groups of people that are kind of traditionally marginalized or ignored. And I would hope that having experienced COVID, it's something that we can all kind of reference, I hope kind of gives us more empathy for groups of people in parts of the world that have to deal with very serious diseases all the time. And that, you know, again, like these things exist in a really complex biosocial context. There is a lot of data and information from the past that can be really, really useful in helping us understand how people live and die under these conditions. So it's not just that modern research can fill in important gaps about what happened in the past. The past can be a really powerful tool for understanding the present and making predictions for the future.
I think that this conversation is a really great way to end. And just thinking about that, your research is allowing us this idea that we can really look more closely at the individuals and impacts. And by bringing all of these different things together, we get a more nuanced and perhaps accurate view of the past and these plague pandemics. I want to thank you all for your work on this article, but also for coming onto the podcast to share some of these insights.
Thanks so much for inviting us. Bye. Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you again.
Many thanks to Reed, Janet, Rachel, and Jordan for that illuminating conversation about interdisciplinary approaches to the first plague pandemic. Their article, Burial Archaeology and the First Plague Pandemic, is now free to read on the Speculum website at the University of Chicago Press. Let me also thank the MMA series producers, Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Lauren Lee, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley. In addition, I'd like to acknowledge the members of the Speculum editorial board, along with the Speculum staff, Taylor McCall, Carol Anderson, Esther German, and Yunji Lee. We also need to thank the Graduate Student Committee of the MAA and the Medieval Academy of America itself for its continued sponsorship of this program. Music for the MMA is by Anna O'Connell. I'm Katherine Jansen, editor of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. Speculum is the journal of the Medieval Academy of America and is published by the University of Chicago Press. One of the benefits of joining the Medieval Academy is receiving both the print and digital editions of the journal. Online, you can find us at journals.uchicago.edu. We'll be back in July with another episode of Speculum Spotlight. Goodbye for now.